You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 135 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Hello.
This is the 1 year anniversary. Wait, how many times have I mentioned this?
You tried to do it in like October.
We finally made it to the 1 year anniversary of your best week in Seattle sports history.
Didn't
where
say that.
Every single team lost and most of them folded.
Not all of them lost. You know, Penn's basketball beat Kansas. I mean, they did lose to Gonzaga quite badly.
More to come on that later.
Yes.
But it's a year later. And maybe it's the most important week in Seattle hockey history.
I think it is.
We'll be toasting to that later. But first,
well, I guess the Stanley Cup still has to be the most important week
for the Metropolitans.
Yesterday.
I remember it like it was yesterday.
Oh, man.
But first, we have something important to toast.
Do we?
We have an announcement.
We do. I mean, we've already made the announcement, but it's a new. It could be new to you, the listener.
Anything could be new to you.
that's like was the rerun slogan back in the 90s. It's new to you. If you haven't watched it, was that like UPN?
No, that was NBC over the summer.
That was NBC?
Yeah, if you haven't seen it, it's new to you.
Wow. I'm actually reading a book about NBC in the 90s.
Their Thursday night lineup?
Yeah.
Ugh, must-see TV.
Oh, truly so. Okay, what do we have to drink here? What are we going to toast with?
We're drinking with a beer that I've wanted to drink for a while from our good friends at Silver City Brewery in Silverdale, Washington. We have the Old Scrooge. It's a Christmas ale. It's a limited series. And here's what they have to say about it. The Old Scrooge. Intriguing notes of apple, cherry, and apricot abound from the long boil time, cool fermentation, and extended aging of this dark, malty ale. Celebrate this year's release and save some for next, as this beer matures wonderfully when cellared. We will not be doing that.
No.
We'll just be celebrating this year's release.
We could get a second one and do that, but we are not doing that right now. I felt like we had had this before, but in the 3 year spreadsheet where I've been tracking the beers I drank, it is not in there.
You did
now.
The math?
I did. I really went and looked it up.
I'm pretty sure that I've never had this before, which I'm fired up to drink it.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of these limited edition Silver City beers. They do like a Valentine's series.
Do they?
Most of which are sour. They do like a six beer Valentine's
series.
The
listener can't see. They probably heard it, but they can't see the smug grin when you said sour.
This is like a you beer, though, because you're into darker beers than I am.
Yeah, I'm not huge on darker beers, but this is the right time for them.
All right.
It's cold outside. It's nearly freezing. It's time for a nice heavy beer.
Well, you know what it's the right time for.
What's that?
Cracking open this beer and getting to this announcement.
It is, because the thing we're announcing, it's also the right time for that, given all of the weather factors that I just related. I got a lot of those notes.
Ah, it smells very fruity.
It does.
So, you may have heard us preview this, announce this officially for the first time on the Beast Poet podcast, the Tasteful Profanity podcast, a Beast Poet production.
It was a crossover pod. It was great.
But if you weren't listening to that, we're formally announcing that this winter, basically once Christmas and the NFL regular season is over, when should we start it then?
I was going to start it, say, after the Seahawks season is over.
Oh, so at the end of February?
Well, okay. If they make it all the way to the Super Bowl, we can maybe do it during the bye week in between.
We are going
run the damn table.
A bracket for the best ramen in Seattle.
I'm very excited about this because my ramen knowledge in the Seattle area is quite limited.
I mean, that's why we're doing this, right?
We're exploring. We're learning.
Yeah, we're learning right alongside you.
I don't really know which kind of ramen is my favorite kind of ramen. I just kind of order like randomly whatever sounds good at any given ramen restaurant. And it's always generally very good.
We're going to find out by the end. I mean, we ended up at the end of our search for Seattle's best dumplings really having a sense of what we liked in dumplings.
Yes.
And that's what's going to happen with this ramen bracket. We are very open to suggestions.
Yes.
We are going to be going out there eating so much ramen. We hope that you can eat with us. We are excited.
It is hashtag ramen season.
Literally ones of people have asked for this.
That's true. That's accurate. That checks out.
I'm more fired up about this than almost any search we've done.
Interesting.
Because ramen is excellent. Maybe it's just I'm fired up about every search, but it's the time of year for ramen.
It's like how every election is the most important election because the results of the previous ones are known. They can't change anything now.
Yes.
But this one is uncertain.
Yes. So again, a toast to the ramen bracket. Again, if you have a favorite ramen in Seattle, please let us know. What are the ones that we've heard quite a bit so far?
Let me look this up here. Third Pelton brother Jake One had some thoughts after the famous cousin Katie posted on Instagram and we reposted on Instagram.
Jake One responded no.
Whether Arashi ramen in South Center area is the best in Seattle. It's my favorite I've had so far, but again, my Seattle ramen experience.
We have so
is
much more ramen.
Too.
We have eaten less ramen because at this time last year with the dumpling bracket, we'd had Din Tai Fung and Dozon.
Yes.
And I don't feel like either of us has eaten most of the real competitors for Seattle's best ramen.
I'm not sure. The other one I've had would be the one that's in the mall, Kazuki.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if it's even a competitor for Seattle's
like
best ramen.
All ramen is kind of the problem.
It's, yeah, you need to have your palate become more refined.
Well, that's the thing. At this time last year, I liked all dumplings. And by the end, I didn't like all dumplings.
I still like all dumplings, I got to be honest with you. So he mentioned Tsukushinbo, which does 50 bowls only on Friday
at
noon.
There we go. When we're there, there's going to be 48 bowls left.
Okay. And then also Danbo on 12th and Pike.
Danbo, I think, is the one that we've heard a couple times.
Yes, we have heard that multiple times.
So, again, if you have suggestions that are not either of those, and we'll definitely be going to those.
I would assume the Maono ramen is a certain competitor.
Maono ramen?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't even know that Maono did ramen.
I think so. I'm pretty sure they do ramen, right?
There we go.
I've never ordered it because I've always wanted to get the chicken. Maybe we had it one time when we were eating family style there.
You know, this summer we're doing a search for Seattle's best sandwich.
People didn't know that, first off.
People forget this by next summer. I'm just so excited about that. Do you think the Maono chicken sandwich counts as a sandwich?
Of course it counts as a sandwich. Yes.
Here's what I was thinking. I was actually thinking of this for sandwiches. I think we have like four different regions, right?
Uh-huh.
We do like deli style sandwiches.
Oh, okay.
So maybe like deli sandwiches, maybe like hot deli sandwiches. Like, where would the Raging Cajun fit? Because it's not really a deli sandwich.
I think it's a deli sandwich.
But, like, we could be talking, like, Jewish delis, right? You know what I mean? Like, traditional deli sandwiches.
Yeah.
And then we have, like, hot deli sandwiches.
I guess that's right. Technically, they have a Simon, not a ramen.
I don't know the difference. We will, though.
I'm pretty sure they're, like, cousins. It's like the pork bat.
Uh-huh. It's the famous cousin Katie.
Yes.
Yeah. But then we do a chicken sandwiches, right? And then maybe an other category, because like banh mi would count, stuff like that.
There's going to be a lot of options. It's a very broad category.
Anyway, we're going to need Third Pelton Brothers to help us eat this ramen along the way. Let us know if you're interested. Tell us your favorite ramen. Tell us your favorite top ramen recipe. Tell us everything that you have to say about ramen.
God, what a tough task to have to eat ramen. But someone is going to have to do it besides us.
But before then,
another on the food topic, an update to the Taco Time Northwest Order Ahead app, more locations now available for Order Ahead. And it's conveniently a South End heavy list. Auburn, Lakeland Hills, Burien, is Chris Smith teased on Twitter, retweeted from the Talk and Taco Time account. Des Moines, the Fairwood location. The Tequila International Boulevard, which is my home location, and Tequila West Valley
Highway. Both of our home locations
are
getting in-app ordering. This is a big deal.
Yes. It's a game changer. We've talked about it already on Talkin' Taco Time, how it has opened up the ability to customize orders in ways that just are never realistic if you're trying to go in and order at the counter.
I did that this weekend. I I ordered at the counter a customized order, and it was one of the worst experiences of my entire life. Well, and the cashier's entire life. Nobody involved wanted the situation to be happening.
Yep.
So, very stoked that this is happening.
I'm very excited to try this at these new locations and report back on a future Talkin' Taco Time episode. But that's not what we're here to discuss today, because we have a lot of sports to get to, despite that ramen discussion.
You're so angry about the ramen discussion.
I'm not angry about it.
Okay.
We want to start, though, before we get to the other toast this week, some news that hopefully will be positive down the road. Former UW guard Markelle Fultz, now with the Philadelphia 76ers, diagnosed after meeting with specialists and announced on Tuesday that he has thoracic outlet syndrome. It's commonly seen among baseball pitchers, and it's basically a situation where, you know, the in his case, it's a nerve. It can also be a blood vessel is caught between your clavicle and your rib cage, and that creates numbness in the arm, weakness in the arm. A whole host of symptoms that hopefully explain what we've seen from Markelle Fultz on the court the last couple of years here.
What is the recovery time from something like this?
They said that they're going to try rehab in a 3 to 6 week timeline.
So are they doing anything about it, though? Like, is there surgery?
Surgery would only probably be necessary if it didn't respond to the non-surgical rehab and, you know, that sort of thing.
But what's the difference between that and what he's been doing?
I mean, now there are specific things you can do to try to alleviate that issue, I guess, basically, huh, in terms of stretches and that sort of thing. I don't know what those are, as I'm not a doctor. But it was interesting. There was a piece on The Ringer about this and noted that baseball pitchers have not tended to come back very successfully from this.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, that's a totally different element altogether. The act of pitching is so much more stressful in the arm than shooting a basketball is. So I don't know if you can necessarily draw that comparison.
Are we supposed to just believe this?
The symptoms that Fultz has exhibited are consistent with what's typically described in thoracic outlet syndrome. So okay, we'll see.
I mean, I'm very curious to see if they do get to a point where they feel like he is fully recovered from this, what that looks like for his game.
Absolutely.
And is this something that we, like, let's say that we are just taking this at face value, right? And it's not agent speak. Is this something that would have extended back to, like, around when he was drafted all of last season?
I mean, I think it definitely could explain what happened last season as well. Yeah.
Man, I'm fascinated.
Yeah.
I mean, does this change, if you're Philadelphia, I mean, you wrote a story about whether the Sixers should trade Markelle Fultz, right?
Yes.
And what was your conclusion?
That if there isn't a medical explanation, that they probably should look to trade him because, you know, he's not likely to be effective without a jump shot, and his salary is actually pretty high for a team that's looking to use cap space this summer.
Does this change things for you?
Sure. I mean, if there's a chance that this is the reason he hasn't been able to shoot the ball outside the lane and all of a sudden that changes, then he goes back to being the guy that was so great at UW and that was drafted number one.
God, I hope so.
Yeah.
Well, we're pulling for you, Markelle.
Absolutely. Okay, in happier news, as you mentioned.
That was kind of happy news.
Potentially
happy. Having news. An explanation for what happened beyond he has the yips or whatever.
Exactly.
Is very much happy news.
Exactly. But in unequivocally happy news.
Ramen bracket level happier news.
The NHL made it official on Tuesday, voting unanimously to award Seattle an expansion 32nd franchise in the league. We knew this was happening. If you go back a couple of years ago to when we were going over Key Arena renovation versus Soto, made it very clear that as soon as there was an arena, the NHL was coming here. So the one thing we did learn today that was new information is that officially it will be the 2021-22 season as a start date for the NHL franchise rather than the 2020 start that they had hoped to get. Todd Leiwicki's quote about this to the Seattle Times: "We went back and forth on it for weeks. In the end, they figured, why risk it? Do you really want your team to start on the road? Have your team play all its home games? Have your team play all of its home games at the arena they're going to call home?" Also noted during the press conference today, it gives them the chance to hold the expansion draft introduce those players, potentially even, nah, probably not the announce a name and logo, more on that in a second, but do that in the arena after it's completed. And the groundbreaking on the arena reconstruction will take place on Wednesday because of the fact that that was prohibited until an NHL team was secured. Pre-construction work has been taking place for the last 2 months since the last event there, the NBA preseason game between the Warriors and the Kings. Laiwicki also said today that with this new timetable, they plan for the arena to open in early 2021 in time for the Storm's 2021 season. And that'll be cool, I think, for the Storm, which was the last tenant to play games at Key Arena, winning a championship this season, to also reopen the arena in 2021 ahead of the start of the NHL franchise.
Interesting. So they'll be there first. It won't necessarily be people's reintroduction to the arena at hockey games. They could go there for Storm games beforehand.
Yes.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. The projected cost of the renovation has risen again to $800 million.
Can't believe that happened. Nobody could have predicted this.
I believe I heard from one person who's familiar with arena construction that they thought it would eventually be over $1 billion.
Okay.
As we've noted...
It's just like, what's an extra $200 million at this point?
As we've noted in the past, though, the more money that Oakview Group puts into the construction of the arena, the more money that they have to be able to get back. And that becomes a complication if it's an outside partner looking to bring an NBA team to play in the arena.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You can delete this, but I did hear also, I was wondering about the construction work because I heard this week that KXP isn't able to record in studios. They built this brand new studio, right? At Seattle Center. Have you heard this?
No.
At Seattle Center, they haven't been able to record in studios because of construction work happening from Key Arena.
That's odd that it would be true even now before they've really started construction in earnest.
Yeah, makes you think maybe that's going to be the case for like 2 years.
I think they were they are in the process of constructing a noise blocking fence, basically, that was part of the plan that they came up with to kind of mitigate the effects of the construction. So maybe it's until that goes up.
Okay. Till the noise blocking fence goes up.
Noise blocking fence is not a technical term there. Don't quote me on that one. The general sense of things.
And a hockey team is not technically a basketball team also.
Todd Lewicki also said, as far as the name, we're going to take our time. There was a lot of talk about engaging fans and getting them on board with this. Feels like a lot of momentum for Steelheads right there. Now,
Steelheads?
Yeah. I like a salmon-related name as long as it's plural. That's my number one criteria on names. It has to be plural because singular names are too annoying. Speaking as someone who spent a decade working for the Seattle Storm and writing about them.
Oh, yeah. Because you have to say, like, the Storm is or something?
You have to choose between either saying is the Storm is, which sounds bad, or yes, the Storm are, which also sounds bad.
Why does that Storm are? That doesn't sound too bad.
It does to me.
Sorry about that. Well, if you recall, I made a bold prediction for calendar year 2018.
Oh, I recall. I listened to that entire episode today to double check our bold predictions.
Oh my! I hate when you review the bold predictions close to the end of the year. I like finding out about them right away.
What do you mean?
I like when we do the recap pod, I want to rehear the bold predictions.
I mean, you will be rehearing the bold predictions.
Yeah, but when you knew them beforehand, it's not as much fun.
Someone has to check them to see if they're accurate or not.
It's only December 4th. Many of these bold predictions could come true in the next 27 days.
I mean, you have one that's like completely open-ended. I have no idea how to score it or not.
I don't know what it is, but I'm scoring it a win.
Mine tend to be a little more rigid.
How are we doing on the bold predictions?
You are doing better than I am.
Of course. God.
But let's just say that you have at least one that's more spectacularly wrong than any of mine.
Oh, no. It's definitely a Mariners one, right?
It's not.
Oh,
you didn't make any Mariners ones, I don't believe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That was a good... I've been ignoring this team for a long time before the next 3 years happen.
Let's see. The other thing that was reported today, Pierre LeBrun of The Athletic, their NHL reporter, reported that the team could look to hire a GM as soon as next summer. So that would be a little earlier than the typical, I think, expansion timeline. Previously, they had been thinking of hiring a GM about 15 months before the expansion draft, which would be similar to the Las Vegas timeline. But now that you have this extended period until that's going to happen, they may move more quickly on the GM front. or not necessarily more quickly, but at least earlier in the process. All right, I didn't write anything down. So it's time for an impromptu version of your favorite segment. Seattle may have gained an NHL team this week, but they lost a baseball team because the Seattle Mariners are no longer an MLB team after the series of trades they've made over the past few weeks. Let me tell you something. There were six hitters on the Mariners roster last year who were worth at least one win above replacement, according to Baseball Reference. You don't want to know how many of those hitters are still on the roster?
How many?
One. Mitch Haniger is the only one. Three of them have been traded. Mike Zunino, of course, a couple weeks ago. Gene Segura. And now Robinson Cano is part of this massive salary dump with the New York Mets, leaving only Nelson Cruz and Denard Span are both free agents, leaving only Haniger on the roster. They've also traded away three of these seven pitchers, who had at least one win above replacement last season, meaning there's a total of five players left out of the 13 last year on a team that was not very good when you looked at the actual run differential in the first place. But here's the thing. I don't think that in this case, Jerry DePoto is the Grinch, because he's doing what's right for the team long term. Look, this is a team that was going nowhere. One of my all-time favorite quotes, when Bob Whitsitt took over as the Sonics general manager in 1986 and traded Jack Sigma to the Milwaukee Bucks. Shouts to Jack Sigma. Someone at the press conference was, you know, questioning him on this decision. And Bob Whitsitt was like, "What exactly is it you object to me tearing apart? The team, I think, had gone 30-52 the year before." And that's how I feel about this Mariners team. They were going nowhere anyway. They had the luckiest season possible last year in terms of one-run games and still couldn't get to the playoffs for the 17th consecutive year. Look, the old way sure as hell wasn't working. So tearing it down, starting fresh, actually rebuilding the farm system, getting some of these terrible contracts off the books, it can't possibly be a worse strategy than all of the ones that preceded it. So I say to you, Trader Jerry, well done on this one.
I don't know if I actually believe that. In theory, it's well done, but you have to actually get the right kind of prospects back.
They did trade for a lot of pitchers.
That's what I was going to say. The prospects who are least likely to develop over time, who have risk of blowing out their arms, or just not even becoming good players, are overwhelmingly pitchers, and they went out and traded for a ton of pitchers. I don't think there are basically any batters that they traded for who are good prospects in this haul.
I thought one of the prospects from the Mets was a hitter.
Definitely not one of the higher level prospects. But then also going out and just trading Gene Segura for like two washed up major leaguers. Like, these are just salary dumps. In theory.
Yeah, they needed to dump salary.
In theory, this is the right proposition. But also, you can't just change your plan halfway through. Look, commends to Trader
Jerry. It wasn't halfway through. It was through. That was it. Last year was it. Nelson Cruz is a free agent. He's not walking through that door.
He's halfway through Trader Jerry's tenure because they zigged and now they're zagging. If he was Sam Hinkie and he came in at the very beginning when they had a farm system and actually like dumped all these players then, that would be one thing. But instead, he tried to go all in one season, traded away their entire farm system, and now, after it didn't work, is trying to get it back. The only thing we should be commending Trader Jerry on is that he will be long fired by the time any of this comes to fruition.
That might not be the worst thing.
Every single person involved in the organization, maybe all the way to the top.
That seems unlikely.
Most of the people in management at the organization will be gone by the time that they see through this overhaul of the organization and their prospects.
They got the number 6 overall pick in last year's first round, who is an outfielder taken
really?
By the Mets. Yeah.
He was the number 6. Well, all right, I take that back.
Apparently a lot of people think he's wildly overrated, but the Mariners liked him.
I mean, whatever. They swindled the Mets. They dumped a contract that they didn't even want in Robinson Cano's contract.
It seems like a much clearer, better trade than the Philadelphia trade.
Yes.
A little harder to understand.
There's some where it's just like you're literally just trading players to be trading players. Like, you could have waited a week. You don't have to make all of the trades within a 2-week span.
Oh, what, you're assuming that this is all of the trades? Are you familiar with Jerry DePoto's work?
His
quote to Ryan Divish of the Seattle Times was, "We're probably done until the winter meetings. The winter meetings start in less than a week."
There's just not that much else left to trade.
They've got players they got in these trades. If you don't think they can trade...
They're going to trade those players.
If you don't think that they can trade for and trade away players in the same offseason, you, sir, do not know Jerry DePoto.
You're right, though. Their chances, the Mariners' chances of winning a World Series with this current roster were basically zero.
Yeah.
And the Mariners' chances of winning a World Series in 4 years after bottoming out, if they can pick up the first or the second pick in these drafts.
Did the Astros have a name for what they were doing? I mean, not that Trust the Process was actually the Sixers' invention. They didn't call it that. That was outsiders calling it that.
But, I mean, the Astros were wildly lucky with what they did.
I mean, you've got to be lucky with any strategy.
And to be able to have it work that quickly. But they got an influx of talent very quickly. I mean, they probably had prospects before they started that process.
Yeah, they hadn't completely stripped down their farm system.
But it's going to be, we're talking like they need to have whatever pick they have this year. Probably it's like not an amazing pick that they have in the like 10s to 15s or whatever. So that. And then they need to have 3 to 4 seasons of first or second or third picks in the draft. And then they'll have a farm system. Like, this right here is just the start. It is going to take years for this to actually matter. And it is going to be years of terrible baseball that we're watching.
What do you mean, watching?
Define watching.
It'll be years of terrible baseball that we will not be paying attention to, which is possibly the best outcome.
It's going to be a huge seafare next summer.
It is funny. You mentioned anniversaries at the start of the pod. Thursday is the 5-year anniversary of the Robinson Cano signing, putting us precisely halfway through that 10-year contract he signed.
I don't think, all things considered, I mean, look, from the Mariners' perspective, they got what they wanted out of Cano. He was relatively productive for the first 5 years, and then they're able to flip him halfway through for good prospects. Yeah, that's best case scenario. Felix Hernandez that's the albatross.
Well, they were able to flip Edwin Diaz for good prospects.
They were at least able to dump his salary.
Yeah, it wasn't a terrible outcome for them, and Ben Lindbergh had a good piece on the Ringer about how much better this outcome was than most free agents signed in their 30s, but still, it was not a good contract. You know, it was a better contract signed or agreed to on December 6th, 2013.
Chris Peterson.
Yeah, that worked out.
That really was. Oh, what a day that was.
It really was. We turn our attention now to the University of Washington. We'll get to football in a minute, but we start with men's basketball coming off a 67-63 win on Sunday against UC Santa Barbara. A game where, again, the Huskies struggled in terms of their three-point shooting, going 5 of 21, a big factor in UCSB staying in this game. And the Huskies led by just 3 late, instead of giving Santa Barbara a chance to tie, intentionally fouled. They split 2 free throws. Jalen Noel made 2 at the other end, and that was that in terms of providing the final 4-point margin. The level of competition gets a lot tougher on Wednesday night when the Huskies head to Spokane to take on number 1 Gonzaga.
God, I hate hearing that sentence.
Gonzaga's really good, man.
Ugh.
They've started the season 8-0, ascended to number 1 after beating then number 1 Duke to win the Maui Invitational. They also beat Arizona in Maui, and then over the past weekend got an impressive win at Creighton. They're only 4th in the KenPom rankings so far, but that's partially because they started all the way down in 9th.
Also only 4th.
Well, yeah, but as compared to being number 1 overall. They're doing this all without injured starter Killian Tilly. Rui Hachimura, who is now an NBA lottery pick prospect, I think, has grown into a much larger role as a junior. Japanese hero Rui Hachimura, going to be the greatest Japanese basketball. Already is probably the greatest Japanese basketball player of all time.
I've never heard of this very moment. But yeah. I already kind of like them.
Yeah, you're missing out. Transfer Brandon Clark, who came from San Jose State, has proven really an upgrade on Tilly. He's 11th in the NCAA in block rate so far and 12th in true shooting percentage. The Zags do have some depth concerns without Tilly and injured grad transfer Gino Crandall, one of the players who's been seeing some action lately. Freshman Greg Foster Jr., son of the one-time Sonic center.
KenPom. So did he live? Greg Foster still probably lived in the Northwest.
No, He's an assistant coach for the Bucks, so his son grew up in Milwaukee. I mean, he didn't grow up.
But... He just randomly went to Gonzaga?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
KenPom gives the Huskies a 10% chance of pulling the upset, which is like 10% higher than I would give them, quite frankly.
It's no 10%.
You're telling me there's a chance territory with the Huskies here. I mean, look, if they can be competitive, that's a huge win.
I mean, a year ago this week, they went to Kansas and upset Kansas, who ended up being a number one seed in the NCAA tournament, right?
That sounds about right.
So you're telling me there's a chance?
That was an incredible performance. This Gonzaga team is better than that Kansas team. I would put it that way. They ended up ninth in KenPom rankings, but were a number one seed, yes, despite those back-to-back losses to UW and Arizona State, both in the state of, or not in the state of Kansas, in the Kansas area during non-conference play. Because that game was played at the Sprint Center in Kansas City.
Oh, our game?
Yes.
Yeah, that was in Missouri.
Yes. Not technically. In Kansas.
That's why they lost.
Exactly.
If only we could play this game in Boise or something.
I don't know if that
Wait, Boise is really far away from Spokane. Never mind.
Moscow?
Yeah.
Is that what you were going for?
I guess so.
I don't know if the
Kimmy... There was some podcast geography there.
Yeah, there really was. I don't know if the Kimmy Dome is big enough for this one. Maybe they could play in Pullman. The Huskies have a better chance of picking up another in-state win on Sunday when they will host Seattle University. Coming off a 20-win season under first-year head coach Jim Hayforth, Seattle U has started 8-2, including 2-0 against Washington D1 teams, with a 78-69 win over Wazoo at the Showare Center and a 20-point blowout of Eastern Washington on campus. Still only ranked 192nd in KenPom, though. They lost at home to Southern Utah for one of their two losses, the other one coming at Stanford. They're shooting 38% from three this season, but have not been very effective defensively. And KenPom gives this the opposite.
I was going to say...
This time it's the Huskies with the 90% chance of winning.
10% comes in a lot of different forms.
That's true.
In the same
way, we know with the way we
can have the same percentage chances of victory, but one is a confident 10%. This is an unconfident 10% for the Huskies to win in Gonzaga. This is a very nervous 90%. They're going to lose this freaking game. They're going to lose both of these games.
I mean, I'm worried about Seattle U getting hot from three-point range, but I don't think they can defend UW. I don't think they can defend Noah Dickerson.
We're going to lose. Oh, it's terrible. They almost lost it. How is...
Is UC Santa Barbara good?
Yeah, how does
Seattle U is rank? Slightly worse than UC Santa Barbara.
Could have easily lost UC Santa Barbara.
It was just a weird game. It wasn't a bad game. I'm not concerned about that, actually. Not really concerned about it at all.
Where do you rank Gonzaga basketball vis-a-vis Oregon football?
Not even close. I don't have the kind of negative feelings about Gonzaga that you do. Oh, I have mixed emotions about Gonzaga.
You love Gonzaga?
I don't love them. First off, when Gonzaga went up against Oregon in the Final Four, it was very clear to me where my allegiances lied there.
Wait, I didn't want... With who?
With Gonzaga.
How?
I mean, I didn't want...
That's a tough one.
I didn't want either of those two teams to win a national championship and be able to hold that over us. That would not have been great. But, again, I want Gonzaga to be reasonably successful. I was kind of bummed when they lost in the Sweet 16 last year before I went to Spokane.
What was it that Mark Few did to Lorenzo Romar?
I think he turned the UW program in for recruiting violations regarding Josh Heupfeld, who, of course, was definitely worth recruiting violations.
Has Oregon ever done anything like that?
I could think of some things, but those are not on the record things.
About the Huskies?
Yes.
What are these off the record things?
I mean, there was a player who was probably going to transfer to UW, and then he transferred to Oregon instead.
From where?
I do know what player. I don't want to reveal too much here.
Okay, what year are you talking?
This is, what, about 4 or 5 years ago?
It's a different thing, though.
Is it? It's the same coach.
This is basketball or football?
This is basketball.
I was thinking you were talking about football. But it is a different thing. Whatever you're implying is different than explicitly reporting UW.
This might have helped Lorenzo Romar keep his job longer. So I think it was probably a bigger deal in that sense.
What Oregon did there, from what you're implying, is the same thing that we now know most colleges were doing.
That's very fair. That's very fair.
Mark Few went out of his way to report Lorenzo Romar.
Yeah.
You've got nothing in there?
I didn't say this feeling was about Mark Few individually.
Okay, it's just the Gonzaga program. Mark Few is the Gonzaga program.
I know more. I know a lot of Oregon fans, so this is the tough thing to say. But I know more Gonzaga fans well that I want them to have success.
Well, hopefully not tomorrow night.
Yes. UW women's basketball did get the win over Seattle University 69-58 in a game played on Seattle U's campus, and then came back home, quote unquote, I put that in air quotes, you can't see that as the listener, to dominate George Mason in an 81-52 win on Sunday, moving to 5-3 on the young season, heading into a showdown on Wednesday against Ohio State and former UW women's basketball coach Kevin McGuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah. McGuff led Ohio State to both the Big Ten regular season and tournament championships last year, but lost all five starters, including WNBA-bound Kelsey Mitchell and Stephanie Mavunga. They've started this season 3-2. They had two of their games. They've only played five games because they had games at Sac State and at Stanford canceled due to the fire in Northern California. They lost their opener at home to South Florida and then also lost by 32 to UConn in Storrs, which no shame in that, but have a win over North Carolina. So, you know, I think Ohio State definitely the favorite in that game, but an interesting opportunity for UW to face a top-tier opponent at home.
It will not be the first time you say that on this podcast.
What do you mean? That it's a likely loss to Ohio State?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
But it's a great opportunity to face a top-tier opponent.
But the at home being a key part, I guess that one's in the Pacific on the Pacific time,
West Coast.
Yeah, a team we have not reported on, but have been remiss in not doing so. UW volleyball toast to reaching the Sweet 16.
Finally, we can celebrate some UW sports
for the sixth time in the last seven seasons, sweeping number 9 seed Creighton in Omaha to get there. They had gone to the Sweet 16 5 years in a row prior to losing in the second round last year. The Husky volleyball team now headed to Palo Alto to face Penn State in a regional semifinal. The regional hosted, of course, by number 8 seed Stanford. If the Huskies are able to advance, the Cardinals swept UW home and away during the regular season.
So where are the Huskies ranked?
You only rank like the top, the hosts of the 16 sub-regionals.
So they're not ranked in like the Sweet 16 or whatever?
Yeah.
And if they were to beat Penn State, then they would play Stanford?
Yes.
Ooh.
Assuming Stanford wins the other matchup there, which is very likely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good luck.
All right, lastly, UW football. We had a reaction pod, a first thoughts about the Rose Bowl matchup against Ohio State. Since then, we've learned something important, that being that this will be Urban Meyer's final game for Ohio State.
What a cool opportunity.
He announced his retirement on Tuesday, effective after the game.
Can we air quote retirement? Come on.
I like that his quote was like, I don't expect to coach again or something like that.
He's retiring like Jay-Z retired.
We'll see.
Sorry. He may be retiring like Jay-Z retired.
Jay-Z might have been retired.
We know that Jay-Z wasn't retired.
I mean, Urban Meyer at no point said he was going to come back like Jordan Ware in the 4-5.
Once he's like in the middle of the game, he's going to say that. It's going to be his halftime speech to his team.
I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the health issues he's been dealing with, similar to what led him to leave Florida and take a hiatus in his coaching career before going to Ohio State. It's obviously been...
Have you been reading the think pieces about it?
No.
Okay. I mean, they definitely haven't been glowing Urban Meyer think pieces.
They should not be. They cannot be and should not be.
I mean, there are other coaches who could have gone through similar situations as Urban Meyer, right? And still could have gotten their victory lap. I just think there's something about Urban Meyer and his approach that makes people not like him.
I don't know. I mean, to some extent, it's a different, hopefully more enlightened time. So obviously what we're referring to is, so Meyer will be succeeded by offensive coordinator Ryan Day under the Ohio State succession plan. Day coached the season's first three games while Meyer was suspended for, quote, not upholding the values of the university while handling allegations of domestic abuse against wide receiver coach Zach Smith, who was fired in July and later pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge of disorderly conduct. It was something that certainly did not reflect well on Urban Meyer, and it seemed at that point like he might not keep his job. He eventually did, but clearly at a cost.
And the university let him have the season.
I mean, I don't know that he like made it clear to them that he was going to retire.
No, I'm saying that they gave him the opportunity to go out on his own.
Yes.
Right? The university, he could have continued coaching after this. They would have been happy to have had Urban Meyer back.
Yes.
And they chose to look past what he did in the situation and let him continue coaching the school.
Yeah.
It's nice to have a clear villain, I feel like. Right? It's more fun that way.
I mean, it's not like, it's more fun, I think, with someone who's like a villain in air quotes.
But like Jim Harbaugh.
That was exactly Jim what I was going Harbaugh. To say.
Is such a perfect...
He's a foil.
Yeah.
But...
You love to play Jim Harbaugh. We're more disgusted by Urban Meyer.
But it's like it's a sports hate kind of thing with Jim Harbaugh.
Yes.
And I secretly kind of love Jim Harbaugh. You know that.
If Jim Harbaugh succeeded Chris Peterson, if somehow the world aligned that for some reason Jim Harbaugh was the next coach of UW after Chris Peterson...
Which would be weird because...
Unabashed love.
We've talked in the past about the idea that like whatever the coach's philosophy informs the fan base's philosophy. I feel like that would happen somehow with Harbaugh. Like khakis? All of a sudden... Well, I'm already into khakis. You know.
Oh, that. God.
But all of a sudden we'd like fullbacks.
I don't think that's happening.
Other news since...
Anyway, good riddance to Urban Meyer. The thought that we could send him out on this retirement with a loss in his last game would be very sweet.
In other news, Ben Burkervin named the Pac-12 Defensive Player of the Year on Tuesday. He follows Vita Vea last year as the second consecutive Husky winner of this award.
2 years in a row.
Huskies also placed four players on the All-Pac-12 first-team defense, including who we think is probably the more rightful winner of the Defensive Player of the Year award, that being Byron Murphy.
I mean, certainly came on at the end of the year. Ben Burkervin, I will say, steadying factor for most of the season, cleaned up a lot of messes.
Yeah, I mean, tackling is such a priority.
Especially in college.
Yeah, at the collegiate level. And I mean, there's plays he made that... You don't know if anyone else necessarily would have been able to make, but still, I think if you gave me the choice and only gave me one UW defender, I would probably take Byron Murphy, and I'd probably take Taylor Rapp, who also was named to the All Pac-12 first team defense ahead of Ben Burkervin as well. Greg Gaines, the fourth Husky named to the first
Greg
team
Gaines.
Defense.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I mean,
and then Miles Bryant is a nickelback made the second team.
Really?
UW. Yep.
There we go.
No offensive players for the Huskies. We had the first team. Miles
Gaskin.
The
first team running backs? That's what I was wondering.
You know, Benjamin of Arizona State and J.J. Taylor of Arizona, who were the conference's two leaders in rushing yardage and did both average more yards per carry than Gaskin. I looked that up.
I mean, Gaskin's stats weren't necessarily that good.
No, they were not.
Who were the quarterbacks? I guess Minshew.
Yeah, Gardner Minshew and K.J. Costello.
God.
I think that's fair.
Ah, KJ Costello is so good.
Elijah Molden also made it as a second team specialist on special teams for his coverage. We also talked on that podcast on Sunday about the line for the Rose Bowl. I predicted about Ohio State plus 4.5. It looks like depending on your location of choice, the line opens somewhere between Ohio State or Huskies plus 4 and Huskies plus 5, and has now risen to Huskies plus 5.5 or higher. Is the early money seems to be coming in on Ohio State.
Okay.
Lastly,
my feelings have not changed since Sunday.
That the Huskies are the better team?
Yeah, my feelings have not and will not change.
Will they change at any point during the game?
Never.
Lastly, on the UW football front, the Pac-12 announced on Tuesday the 2019 schedule. Teams will have two bye weeks in 2019 due to the calendar. It's an early Labor Day and a late Thanksgiving, so there's 14 weeks of the college football regular season instead of the regular usual 13. The Huskies' first bye won't come until week 9, the latest of any Pac-12, with a second one in week 12. So they'll have, you know, a couple of opportunities to rest late in the season. As far as notable games, they'll face USC in week 5, visit Stanford in week 6, with Oregon coming to Husky Stadium in week 8. It's a schedule that sets up pretty favorably for the Huskies. We've talked about this in the past. They have Stanford and Oregon are on opposing years, but they get Oregon and Wazoo both at home, as well as USC. Those are perhaps three of your four most difficult games. They also get Utah at home next year in a rematch of the Pac-12 championship game. So the home schedule is going to be loaded after being relatively weak this year.
So a Pac-12 game in week 2.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a little unusual. I mean, it's not quite like opening the year against Auburn, which I prefer to avoid, but that's a relatively early Pac-12 game for sure.
And especially playing a team like Cal, who we assume should be a pretty good team next year.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, getting it at home is nice, but I was thinking that they'd have a pretty soft landing for next starting quarterback, most likely either Jake Haener or Jacob Eason. And having a Pac-12 game there in week 2 is not going to be that easy.
Yeah, you're going to be tested right away.
Especially against what might be the Pac-12's best defense.
It was in 2018.
It was?
No. Cal?
Utah was better, weren't they?
No, I think Cal ended up the best.
It is a fascinating schedule. I mean, really, you look at it and you're like, if they are a good team next year, they're run-the-table potential, given the schedule.
Yeah, I mean, Stanford is by far the hardest road game next year.
To me, the hardest road game is somehow Arizona, because it's Arizona. Yeah,
that's a good point. The non-conference slate is much weaker than this year, with at BYU being the marquee non-conference game on the schedule, and it'll be interesting to see how that affects the Huskies.
I mean, the only real chunk, I guess USC will be a good team, but then that 2-week period where they go at Stanford, at Arizona, hosting Oregon.
Yes.
Kind of that period. USC, Stanford.
Yeah, I mean, USC is at the start of that. It's a 4-week stretch.
Okay. Well, yeah. Hosting USC, at Stanford, at Arizona, hosting Oregon before the bye week. That looks pretty brutal. But then after that, you're thinking that they're going to win out from that point.
I don't know if I'm ready to go.
If
there.
They're a good team,
they're going to be favored in all of those games.
When you know the defense is going to have to replace a lot of players. You're going to have a brand new starting quarterback, brand new starting running back. The defense will have to replace a lot of players. However, Chris Peterson has built up the depth on this team so much that we feel like going into any season that they'll be a good competitive team.
Yeah, I mean, defensively, they've continuously lost players to the NFL since Chris Peterson.
We've been nervous about so many generations of players leaving.
Pete Kwiatkowski and Jimmy Lake deserve a lot of credit for that as well, since those guys got here.
We should also mention that the Colorado head coaching job, that there was talk about Jimmy Lake potentially taking that job, not going to Georgia's defensive coordinator.
Yeah, that was good news.
So dodged a bit of a bullet there.
Not that Jimmy Lake won't probably get other offers as the offseason and the coaching searches continue. By the way, Cal finished 8th in FPI efficiency on defense. Utah was 13th and UW 15th. Let's turn our attention now to the Seattle Seahawks coming off Sunday's blowout victory over the San Francisco 49ers. And I got to say, you were much more right than you were wrong about the idea that the Seahawks were going to blow out San Francisco.
Just
you
like
were going to and should have blown out San Francisco.
Just like my bold predictions for 2018. My feel for that Lions game, fantasy football every single year.
Let's not get cocky before we listen to the bold predictions.
You said I was more right than wrong. It's not about how wrong. If you don't have at least one really wrong bold prediction, the prediction wasn't bold enough.
Possibly fair. All right.
I just want to get most of the bold predictions right. Although I guess
I'm just
that
so
also
excited
means,
for you to hear this bold prediction.
Oh my god! I can't wait.
That's the fact that you don't remember it at all is the best part.
The only one that I remember was the one about getting a team and having them. I think I said they would be named the Seattle Salmon, but I'm taking credit for Sockeyes or Steelheads, anything salmon related.
It was a really involved bold prediction, as many of yours are, which makes them difficult to track because you were right about most of it, but wrong about the fact that they would have a team wrong name.
The
NHL projection, yeah. Yes.
I'm close enough, though.
I gave you that one.
Yeah. I'm taking credit for that one. They're going to be named like I'll take Kraken, too. It's a sea creature.
But they aren't going to be named in 2018, so that's where you were wrong. Everything else in terms of the NFC playoff picture, the last 2 weeks, has come up Seahawks.
Man.
The Carolina Panthers are in free fall. They're firing defensive coordinators. Or I'm sorry, not firing defensive coordinators. They fired a member of their defensive staff, but Ron Rivera took back play calling duties from their defensive coordinator.
Really? Defensive yeah. play calling? How often do you see that a coach takes back defensive play calling?
Yeah, midseason, it's unusual.
I don't think I can think of any time that's ever happened. I mean, offensive play calling is one thing, but...
The Packers lost. They fired their head coach.
The Packers are done. Goodbye.
I don't feel like we can celebrate Mike McCarthy being gone, especially if you think back to the 2014 NFC Championship.
Like, really a toast to Mike McCarthy for all he's done for the Seahawks.
Mike McCarthy played in that victory for the Seahawks. Then the Vikings lose to the Patriots, and even the Washington professional football team losing on Monday night to the Philadelphia Eagles. Worked slightly in favor of the Seahawks playoff odds, which are now trending somewhere between 85 and 90% entering Monday night showdown against the Minnesota Vikings, the team right behind them right now in the playoff race.
Whew, man, am I ready for this one? Thank you for saying that I was right about the 49ers game also. I agree.
You're welcome.
It wasn't quite 56-0.
It was not quite that bad, but it was definitely a solid blowout by the Seahawks and one of their strongest performances of the season, moving them up another spot to 10th in DVOA, 9th in weighted DVOA. Now all of their losses to teams in the top 7 in Football Outsiders DVOA. The one downside of the victory over San Francisco, I would say the hamstring injury to DJ Fluker. After further testing on Monday, Pete Carroll said it's a grade 1 hamstring strain. You know, I think that's usually probably somewhere in the range of 2 to 4 weeks.
It must have been hard for him not to have called it a legit hamstring.
And to have done something more specific than that.
Yes, yeah. He's got a grade 1 legit hamstring.
Legit is not, sadly, a medical term. So I'd say a real chance that this ends his regular season and possibly even extends into the postseason.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
True. Should the Seahawks get there?
Yes.
The good news, I think, is that Jordan Simmons has played relatively well when he's been asked to play in place of DJ Fluker, most notably in the game at LA.
Well, I think, you know, one of the first plays that they had after the DJ Fluker injury was the touchdown that Rashad Penny had, right? Running to the left side, not to DJ Fluker's side, but it was like, it just gave you a moment of like, it was almost like a, okay. Like, the Seahawks can still be on their bullshit, right, with this DJ Fluker injury.
Yes. The news better as far as starting running back Chris Carson, who left the game with a dislocated index finger, but should be fine to play against Minnesota. The Seahawks will also this week get back Michael Kendricks returning from his NFL suspension, with KJ Wright continuing to be sidelined. It'll be interesting to see how much they use Kendricks relative to Austin Kalitro, who's played pretty well, I would say.
Yeah, you have to feel good about Austin Kalitro.
Yeah, I think it's probably much more in passing down situations where, you know, I think Kendricks is the better option there than Kalitro. Lastly, any thoughts on Richard Sherman's return before we turn our attention to the Monday night game?
You have to give it to Ben B again when he's like, there really isn't an opportunity. I don't know why people are so up in arms. There's not an opportunity to boo Richard Sherman, right?
Yes.
He's a defensive player that they don't introduce. And he was completely right about that. I mean, Richard Sherman was involved at various times. There was a penalty.
Not that often.
Well, there was a penalty that he had nothing to do with that he highly disputed to the referees. I think it was the a blow to Russell Wilson when Russell Wilson was sliding.
Oh, yeah.
And Richard Sherman was upset about the call, but
which was by Malcolm Smith, right?
Oh, was that Malcolm Smith?
I think it was Malcolm Smith, if I recall.
I mean, the place that Richard Sherman was most present was when the team reenacted the tip in the end zone.
Which was awesome.
It was amazing what they did. I would have loved if they would have gone through. This is like maybe more planning than I would like the team to have done. But if they could have gone through like some Richard Sherman greatest hits along the way.
Yeah, I mean, if they had done the interception of Matt Schaub, is I believe Zach Whitman suggested on Twitter.
Yeah, yeah. Or even like they could have figured out like a you mad bro or something. Right?
But instead, you know what they did?
What?
The Macarena.
The Macarena. Yeah, I was like, the Macarena sensation happened before most of the players were born who were involved.
Oh boy, that's disturbing. I mean, it occurred in 94?
I think it's a little bit later than that.
It was either 94 or 95, I'm pretty sure. Because the specific memory that I brought up that I mentioned on Twitter.
It was when the Mariners broke the record.
The Mariners temporarily set the record for most people doing the Macarena, and I was at this game.
Uh-huh.
And I recall like having you help me learn the Macarena beforehand. Much like David Moore on the sidelines after the first touchdown, practicing the Macarena for the subsequent touchdown. What an amazing time to be alive. Oh, I'm wrong about this. It looks like it was 96 that it achieved its popularity. Yes, it was 1996.
What
so
year do you think David Moore was born?
Probably 95. I think he was probably was alive.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can't believe he didn't learn it.
I know. Does it remember it from age one?
But there was just no moment. There was no moment to boo Richard Sherman. There really wasn't a moment to cheer Richard Sherman. He just, and especially because they didn't throw to his direction, it's just like he wasn't really a factor.
So here's the thing. As I said beforehand that, you know, one of the things you learn when teams play against a former player of theirs is like what the scouting report from them on that player is. And what we learned is, and maybe this doesn't necessarily apply the same way to the 49ers with their otherwise weak secondary that it did to the Seahawks, but they really pretty much adopted the Aaron Rodgers approach of let's never throw to his side,
they learned from Mike McCarthy.
Pick on the other side.
I mean, they exposed the limitations of Richard Sherman.
I don't know if it's even the limitations of Richard Sherman so much as it is the limitations of any cornerback.
I don't know if I fully agree with that. Richard Sherman is more dialed into one side than a lot of elite level cornerbacks.
He is, but also if you're a team like the Seahawks, you don't, first off, you can put your receivers on either side. That's a legal thing.
But second off, they don't have one wide receiver. Tyler Lockett, Doug Baldwin.
Jerron Brown. Big play, Jerron Brown. David Moore, even.
He should have just been playing run defense.
And he even missed a tackle on Doug Baldwin. That was disappointing. Not really.
But if you're Richard Sherman and you're on a bad team, like Richard Sherman is a luxury that bad teams can't afford. Not that they're paying him that much. He doesn't have a great agent. But it's just like having a cornerback who can lock down one side of the field if you don't have the rest of the secondary to go along with it, it's like great, you know? Most teams can exploit that. It's not that hard.
Teams have also been able to exploit the Seattle defense, as it turns out. Nick Mullins threw for a lot of yards, even though it didn't necessarily translate to many points.
I, for one, think Nick Mullins is great.
that's a bold take. The interception finally came. I was waiting for it.
It was a great play that Bobby made.
What a moment.
Can we just, if we're talking about the Seahawks defense being exploited, give credit to Bobby Wagner.
Oh, I mean, Bobby Wagner was not exploited.
Is he in the conversation for Defensive Player of the Year?
No, probably not.
Like, what does Bobby Wagner have to do?
Aaron Donald exists. Like, Aaron Donald.
The Seahawks defense is better than the Rams defense.
Aaron Donald exists.
Is statistically, who's better?
Aaron Donald is off the charts statistically.
But as a defense?
The Seahawks are down to 16th in DVOA.
Bobby Wagner is probably playing with worse players around him than Aaron Donald is.
No, I agree with that. But I think that Aaron Donald is the better choice for Defensive Player of the Year. But Bobby Wagner is an amazing defensive player and had an amazing game on
Sunday.
Bobby
Wagner is not an amazing defensive player. He is.
They are 15th in DVOA. The Seahawks are 16th.
They're an excellent defensive team.
So he had a forced fumble.
Just average.
fumble recovered, sack, interception, touchdown. As I noted on Twitter, that has happened 23 times in the Pro Football Reference database, including one other time
this
season.
How many times has Aaron Donald done that?
He probably has not done that.
It's not really a thing that defensive linemen could do all that easily.
Not so much. This anti-Aaron Donald take is not good.
I'm not
to end
anti-Aaron
well.
Donald. I'm just saying that Bobby Wagner is excellent.
I'm just not pro-Aaron Donald.
Aaron Donald is obviously good. That fumble that Bobby had, the fumble recovery.
That was an amazing play.
Did that happen? Even on the replay, you couldn't really see it.
I think it happened.
You think he pulled it out of there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see. I'm looking at who did this.
It's all Khalil Mack.
There are some defensive linemen on here. Tony Brackens, Jason Taylor did it twice.
Wow.
None of these players are defensive tackles, mind you. Julius Peppers did it. And then Khalil Mack, of course.
So it's give this man defensive player of the year. Put him in the conversation. Give him votes at least. Second place?
He deserves some votes.
We'll take second place.
Khalil Mack probably deserves some votes as well.
Oh, God. Bobby Wagner is carrying this defense. Also the pressure. Him coming in with the sack, that was an interesting one.
Yeah. He's great at that.
And I would like to see more of that going against this Vikings offense.
You know, it's talking about Minnesota. This Vikings offense has been pretty meh so far this season. Kirk Cousins has been fine after he got this giant contract completely guaranteed from Minnesota during the offseason that it's going to... I mean, not that I think that completely guaranteeing Russell Wilson's contract is the worst idea in the world, but it's definitely going to set the precedent for Russ's contract extension.
I mean, he's a much better quarterback than Kirk Cousins is also.
It's like three spots ahead of him QBR. I do think Russ is better. Cousins 14th in QBR. He's completed a career high 71% of his passes, but for just 10.10 yards per completion. So his yards per attempt this season, slightly worse than Case Keenum managed last season.
Love
at
Case
the helm
Keenum.
Of this Minnesota attack. Adam Thielen leads the NFL with 98 catches, catching 73% of his targets. But his fantasy owners of Adam Thielen, like us, know, has slowed a bit lately. Just one game with 100-plus receiving yards in his last four after starting the season with a record-tying 8 consecutive 100-yard receiving games. Still, if you're the Seahawks, you'd rather see the ball go to Stephon Diggs than Adam Thielen. Well, he's not far behind Thielen with 84 catches, ranking 6th in the NFL. Diggs is averaging just 7.0 yards per target as compared to 8.7 for Thielen and 7.7 for Kyle Rudolph, who is one of the league's most reliable tight ends, catching 76% of his targets. The Vikings come into this game dead last in the NFL in rushing DVOA, in large part because of second-year player Dalvin Cook, who has been the league's worst running back in terms of DR. He is averaging 4.2 yards per carry, but when you take out his longest run of the season, a 70-yarder, that drops to just 3.2 yards per carry. Cook did go 9 for 84 against New England last week, not including that 70-yarder was previous in the season.
Well, you say that we'd really want to see the ball going to Stephon Diggs instead of Adam Thielen, which is sort of true, but we definitely want the ball to be going to Dalvin Cook and Latavius Murray.
Yes.
We want the Vikings to come into this game trying to have a Seahawks game plan.
What do you think the odds of that are?
It's not that far-fetched. The Vikings run way too much watching their games. You're just like, this is the worst running up. They're like the Seahawks last year in a way.
I don't know if I would go that far.
There's a hint of it. There's a little taste of last year's Seahawks in this Vikings team.
Okay.
When they're the worst rushing attack and they don't completely abandon the run right away.
Yeah, that's probably true. Minnesota is 29th in the NFL in rushing attempts.
They're 29th in rushing attempts?
Yes. They are third in passing attempts.
All right, I guess I take that back. Maybe this is just being a Stephon Diggs and Adam Thielen passing or fantasy owner that they couldn't pass enough.
Yes, there may be no amount of passing that would be sufficient to satisfy you on this count.
So I suppose I might be biased about that. But we want them to run the ball as much as possible. Knowing that they're going to pass more, I guess that's a little bit scarier. But Kirk Cousins kind of shows that we need to stop at this point in where the NFL is, really even looking at completion percentage as a statistic that we really pay much attention to.
I mean, I think it has some meaning.
I it has very little meaning at this point. You know, there's so many quarterbacks. Like, what is Derek Carr's completion percentage?
Derek Carr has less meaning. So if you go to the NFL Next Gen stats and their expected completion percentage, Derek Carr's is, I think, the highest in the league, if I recall off the top of my head.
Because he's throwing nothing but short passes.
Yes. And that is not actually the case for Kirk Cousins, who has the second highest, like, above, plus minus above expected completion percentage, trailing only Drew Brees.
Really?
Yeah. Russell Wilson tied for third in that stat with Matt Ryan.
Are you trying to tell me that Kirk Cousins is good?
I mean, that's only one measure. The yards per attempt is also an important measure. DVOA is also an important measure. And those show him to be much more mediocre. But I don't know that I would say that his completion percentage itself is strictly a product of easy throws.
Okay. But he's not gaining that many yards per completion.
No.
So I don't know. But what's going to happen for the Seahawks is when the Vikings have the ball, if they do run it and they're getting into third and long situations, they need to get off the field on these third and long situations.
And it'll be tough for them to get pressure. This Minnesota offensive line, and it possibly in conjunction with throwing quicker passes, this is a top five team in terms of adjusted sack rate.
It's going to be hard. Adam Thielen terrifies me.
As well he should.
I mean, but so when the Seahawks have the ball,
I don't like this matchup whatsoever.
It's going to require the Seahawks to play differently than they want to. And I think the Vikings are coming into this game expecting that. Partially, this whole Seahawks like reputation for being a great running team means that teams want to make them not run because they know that they're uncomfortable. And we've talked about this. It's like teams want them to do the thing that they're better at.
They want them to run the good offense. Opposing running backs are averaging just 3.7 yards per carry against Minnesota, the fifth lowest mark in the NFL. They get relatively few stuffs for negative yardage or no gain, but allow very few long runs. It seems that players have a tough time getting to the second level against this Minnesota defense. The other thing this Vikings defense does exceptionally well is rush the passer. Fourth best in adjusted sack rate, Danielle Hunter leads the way with 11.5 sacks, the fourth highest mark in the NFL. Nobody else has more than 3.5 sacks, but six different Vikings have at least three, including former Seahawks Tom Johnson and Sheldon Richardson.
Don't mention their names. It hurts. Both of them.
The one weakness you can really find in this Minnesota defense, they're allowing 8.3 yards per target to opposing running backs, according to Football Outsiders. And I assume there's got to be a lot of screen passes in
JD
there.
JD McKissick time.
JD McKissick. We haven't seen, I don't think the Seahawks ran a single screen pass last Sunday, did they? Like, that kind of has gone dormant for a period of time here. This is the week to bring it back.
To bring back the screen pass. They've been saving it for this game. They haven't put a lot of screen passes on tape because they're saving it for the Vikings. They didn't need it against San Francisco.
It's interesting. The Seahawks have beaten the two opponents they've played with the best adjusted sack rate on defense, those being the Lions and the Packers. But both of those teams were very bad at defending the run, which was a key factor in the Seahawks' success in this game.
This one feels to me more like the Panthers game, where I'm expecting Minnesota to really target the run and to say, this is what we're going to stop. You know, I don't think they're going to score the kind of points that Carolina scored. Not necessarily that it'll be a lower scoring game, but
I think it'll be a lower scoring game. I mean, the Vikings offense has not been putting a lot of points on the board lately.
They won't be anywhere near as explosive as Carolina was.
Yes.
Coming into Seattle with their offense.
I hope so.
But defensively, they're going to try to stop the run and they're going to be loading up on that box. They're going to force the Seahawks to pass the ball. The good thing is that the Seahawks are very good at passing the ball.
Yeah. They don't know it, but they are.
Nobody tell them.
It comes as a complete surprise to them.
If they found out, they'd be angry.
Yeah. No, they want to be good at it, just not as good as at running. I think an interesting potential swing factor in this game, Minnesota's kicking. They have a league worst minus 13.2 expected points on field goals and extra points, according to Football Outsiders. Daniel Carlson, who started the season as their kicker, went 1-of-4 on field goals in the first two games, was then waived and replaced by Dan Bailey, who has come in and made a career low 73% of his field goal attempts, including 2-of-5 the last 2 weeks. this going against the Seahawks team, where the field goal kicking has been pretty good. The extra point kicking on Sunday was shaky at best from Sebastian Janikowski. The good news is it produced a scoregami.
That's all that really matters, too.
Yeah.
I've been going into this game preparing myself to lose.
I mean, it's weird because the Seahawks are a better overall team than Minnesota by whatever metric you choose to look at. And I don't know what metric you would want to look like.
I guess I want to look like DVOA. I think it's not the worst metric to look like. It is interesting when you... I was curious to look back at this Patriots game because I didn't see any of it because it was happening, I think, opposite the Seahawks last week.
Yes.
And I was wondering how the Patriots won.
The first half, it kind of felt like the Minnesota was going to win. They like struggled on offense the first quarter and then got things going, tied the game before halftime. I was like, okay, now they've figured things out. Uh-oh. But then they didn't figure things out, and they didn't do anything offensively in the second half, did not score in the second half.
I mean, 10 points against the Patriots defense is pretty bad. And you mentioned the yards per catch. Adam Thielen at 5.6 yards per catch. Stephon Diggs at 9.8. Like, they're not getting big chunks there. And even Dalvin Cook being dumped out of the backfield, 8 receptions for 22 yards.
Yeah, it wasn't exciting for someone playing against him in a PPR league.
Wait, were you really?
I was.
My God. He actually had a pretty good game rushing.
Fortunately, I had both Keenan Allen and Antonio Brown, so I won that one. I was good.
Good for you. Yeah, people were really rejoicing for you. But the thing that the Patriots did was pass the ball. And they passed the ball successfully, and that's what the Seahawks need to do. I mean, the Patriots, despite the fact that he didn't score touchdowns, if you want to talk about fantasy, they won that game on the back of Tom Brady.
Do you think the Seahawks are going to be willing to do that?
I think if things... It's almost, this sounds weird, you almost want things to get like a little bit ugly early.
Like the Packers game?
Yeah, like, you know, let's say somebody fumbles on the first play of the game.
Okay. You're going to be up there going, yes!
Yes! I'm going to be the one. I'm going to be like, statistically, this is a good thing because they'll get to the offense sooner. Get to the good offense sooner.
Put that on a sign.
Anything that they could do to make them pass the ball. I yell play action before every play now. We've become like weirdly obsessed with play action, I feel like.
I don't know. I don't think there's anything weird about it.
The Seahawks offense has made us the biggest play action stands in the history of time.
Yeah.
But I think that if things don't go great early, let's say that they're down in the third quarter and they need to break out the good offense. You know, they need to do the break in case of emergency good offense. They can score points.
Russell Wilson is the break in case of emergency, by the way.
It's just passing the ball. I mean, yes, it is Russell Wilson. But
he passed the ball 6 times in the first half on Sunday.
There were 3 of them with the touchdowns. There were 3 runs in the first series.
It's really
where they
like
ran
they
ball.
Wanted to make them as hard on themselves as possible.
I almost curled up under my chair and died when they ran the third time.
Oh, boy.
But if they pass the ball, I think things are going to go well. I could see them scoring points relatively quickly with the good offense, getting stops. And it feels like a game that, looking at it statistically and what the Vikings' weaknesses are, if the Seahawks do pass the ball, they can win this by like more than a touchdown.
That's what you take. First off, they're good at defending the pass when it's thrown, too. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not bad at that.
No, it's a good defense, but the Seahawks have a very good passing attack.
They do. I feel more pessimistic about this game than you do, I think. I'm at like 55% chances of victory.
55%?
Yeah.
That's not even backed statistically.
It's the matchup is not ideal. I mean, the Seahawks are a slightly better team and at home. That's like maybe 60%, and then deducting 5% for the matchup.
I think it's more like a 65-70% chance of winning.
Wow.
I feel weirdly good about this one.
I mean, the one thing is the Seahawks have been extraordinarily good in prime time.
You remember last year?
They
did beat the Eagles on prime time last year, but they lost that game to the Falcons. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think they... And also, they lost... The worst loss of the season last year was also to Kirk Cousins.
Wait, last Kirk Cousins last year?
Yeah, that Washington game.
Oh,
you remember he used to be on that team?
I do recall that now that you mentioned it.
Maybe the worst loss of the Pete Carroll era, in my opinion.
Really?
Super Bowl 49. Not in the conversation.
I was going to go to home to Arizona 2 years ago in week 16.
Cost
the Seahawks the 2 seed, forced them to play in Atlanta.
God, that was a bad loss.
Yeah.
And Tyler Lockett got injured, right?
That sounds right.
I think that was the game. Oh, man, that was a rough one. But there's something about that Washington game that really left a bad taste in my mouth for the rest of the season.
Was it the rest of the season?
This one feels okay to me, though. I mean, the Seahawks have beaten every team that they've played who they're better than at DVOA.
Yes.
So.
Well, let's hope that continues.
And where are the Vikings overall on DVOA?
I believe they're 15th. Off the top of my head. Yeah, they are 15th.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about a team that is 6 spots worse than them. You know, the threat level's up, don't get me wrong. But part of it being a bad matchup is they can't do the thing that's kind of gashed the Seahawks a little bit the last few weeks in running the ball. They're an okay passing team, but they're not a great passing team. Are the Vikings really going to score on this defense?
That's if you're going to win. I think it's going to be a low-scoring game.
Yeah, and you pass the ball 15 times. If that's the case, then you pass the ball 15 times or whatever.
Oh, boy, that's not enough passes.
And that's what they want to do.
I know that's what they want to do.
But if the Vikings do get ahead, then you break the glass and you pass the damn ball.
What's the sound of breaking glass?
Psh! Yeah, that's not a good breaking glass sound.
No.
All right, you do a breaking glass sound. That's the worst breaking glass sound I've ever heard.
It sounded better in my head.
That was way better.
Yours was like letting the air out of a balloon.
I guess it is kind of like letting the air out of a balloon. I'm doing the breaking hand motion. Anyway, then they go to that offense. Really, there's no way that the Vikings can win this game.
No way.
What is despite the route to winning?
Despite the 65-70% chances of victory for the Seahawks. No way.
You've talked me into it.
by naysaying?
Yeah.
I hope you're right about this one too.
I just don't see what the game plan is that Minnesota has to win. If their offense plays great, then the Seahawks go to the good offense.
No, but they can still score enough points because they can just matriculate the ball down the field like those 7-yard passes every time.
Yes, I suppose
that's what the Seahawks' single biggest weakness is: allowing extended drives. And then they run the ball twice and throw on 3rd and 10. And Danielle Hunter sacks Russell Wilson and he fumbles. And then Minnesota gets the ball
back.
That,
remember?
We're cheering for that early in the game. What if it happens late in the game?
Oh, no. This is not Phil Rivers. Kirk Cousins is not Phil Rivers, a.k.a. the greatest quarterback in the NFL. Call me when the Chiefs come to town. Don't give me this about the Vikings.
I mean, they're coming to town in 2 weeks. So
we'll probably lose that game. I'm not going to give that a 65-70% chance of victory because that's an actual good team. This is a team that used to be good masquerading.
They're going to keep running the ball even though they can't. You're going to acknowledge that. Yeah, the Seahawks.
They didn't against Carolina as much as they could have. You forget that. When they're bad at running the ball,
And all it took was Graham Gano missing a 41-yard field goal and them getting a field goal in the last minute.
Very hard game. Against what used to be a good team on the road.
Converting a 4th and 3 with a 40-yard touchdown pass to tie the game. That's all it took was that simple.
Where are the Panthers in TVOA? Have they really free
They're ball? The exact same as Minnesota. They're one spot ahead of them and one spot behind and weighted DVOA.
Into their house and beat them.
Despite being outgained by 2 yards per carry.
Christian McCaffrey walking through that door. The Panthers' offense is much better suited to play against the Seahawks. Kirk Cousins is going to be pressured in this game.
Yeah, but the Minnesota defense isn't going to be starting Corn Elder at cornerback. Okay, Corn Elder is not walking through that door. And if he did...
Xavier Rhodes is out, right?
He'll be popped.
Also, you're looking at a Vikings defense that included Xavier Rhodes, a Vikings secondary. Against the Patriots, how did they rank?
I don't know specifically about that game.
Look, I know that the Patriots have not passed the ball all that well this year. Tom Brady was 24-32 for over 300 yards, 10 yards per attempt.
I'm not seeing anything about an injury.
Is Xavier Rhodes just healthy now?
I think he is. Oh, Trey Waynes left last week's game with a concussion. He's questionable. I don't think that's as big of an issue for the Vikings as Xavier Rhodes.
I guess Xavier Rhodes was healthy last week.
Xavier Rhodes, as I know him, the return for Percy Harvin. Does that change your percentage chance of victory?
No, not at all. Bring it on.
Okay, on that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.